Welcome to Dispatches, the official podcast for the Journal of the American Revolution. The Journal of the American Revolution publishes weekly online at www.allthingsliberty.com. For the latest in research, reviews, and commentaries, America's most important history is available free of charge at the Journal of the American Revolution.
And once I thought of connecting Mr. Waters with Josiah Waters Jr. in Boston, then everything clicked into place.
That's Journal of the American Revolution contributor J.L. Bell, discussing Dr. Joseph Warren's 1775 confidential informant. And he's our guest today. I'm Brady Kreitzer, and this is Dispatches. This episode is brought to you by the unexpected Abigail Adams, A Woman Not Apt to Be Intimidated, by John L. Smith, Jr. A Wall Street Journal, What to Read This Spring Selection. Available now wherever books are sold. Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome back to another episode of Dispatches. I'm your host, Brady Kreitzer. Today our guest is longtime Journal of the American Revolution contributor and author, J.L. Bell. And he'll be discussing the confidential informant of Dr. Joseph Warren while he's inside Boston in 1775. J.L. Bell is one of the wonderful contributors we have here at the Journal of the American Revolution, and he produces some of the most fascinating works of scholarship dealing with Boston during the American Revolution itself. This is an absolute home run yet again. Joseph Warren is an interesting figure, as you'll hear in the interview. He has a lot of different sources feeding him a lot of different information about what the British are doing and how they're operating in the year 1775 at the outbreak of the American Revolution. In the end, J.L. Bell reveals these sources as only he can. So sit back, relax, and enjoy our interview with J.L. Bell. J.L. Bell, welcome back to the show.
Thank you very much, Brady.
John, you've been on the show many times before. Remind us about your background.
Well, I am very busy putting together a weekend of history lectures with The Pursuit of History, all about what happened 250 years ago this year in New England. Now, of course, this is 2024, so 250 years ago, 1774, the year before the Revolutionary War broke out. And yet, I think that's a crucial year when everything changed for New England. Basically, the region fell out of control of the British Empire, and we're going to talk about why with a whole bunch of experts. We're going to be visiting places. We're going to be looking at documents. So that's going to keep me busy for the next 3 weeks until it happens in May 10th, 11th, and 12th.
John, what drew your interest into this topic?
Well, I have grown up in Middlesex County, Massachusetts. I was a impressionable elementary school kid during the bicentennial, so I didn't realize until years later how much that imprinted on me, the bicentennial, the revolution. But to me, the revolution, the most interesting parts have long been the run-up to the revolution, the Boston Massacre, Boston Tea Party, the Battle of Lexington and Concord. And so, you know, there's great stuff later in the war. It just doesn't interest me as much. Here's a story about what exactly happened on April 18th and 19th, 1775, and that is what I really get my teeth into. David Hackett Fisher did a terrific book on this in the 1990s called Paul Revere's Ride. And in that book, he talked about some of the early information sources that the Patriots were using to try to figure out what General Thomas Gage was up to. And so I read that before I really got deep into my own research. But that story kept calling me.
For those who don't know, John, give us a primer on Joseph Warren.
Joseph Warren was a member of the Boston Patriots. He was a doctor. He wrote essays, political essays in the newspapers in the 1760s and early 1770s. He delivered the oration memorial for the Boston Massacre in 1772, but he was part of the younger set of Boston Patriot. So he was not like Samuel Adams or in the early 1770s, the leaders just below Samuel Adams were people like William Molyneux and Dr. Thomas Young, names we don't remember so much today, and we'll talk about why. Warren was not quite at that level yet because he was so young. He is still in his early 30s. So there's a very interesting moment. Well, at the Boston Tea Party, for instance, Samuel Adams was up front at Old South Meeting House. Dr. Thomas Young was up front at Old South Meeting House. They were both speaking at the meeting. William Molyneux is probably at the docks. We know that Dr. Joseph Warren was at the meeting house, but he didn't speak prominently. I think that's because as a young man, he was still deferring to the older men. There was a moment in 1774 called the Powder Alarm when there were thousands of militiamen marching toward Boston. Warren got the news of this. He gathered men together, Boston Patriots, and they went out to meet with these men and try to calm them down because they thought that the time wasn't right for an open confrontation. And yet, when they met out on Cambridge Common, Warren did not speak to the men. Other older Boston Patriots did. So even though he was involved in organizing this response, even though he wrote the letter to Samuel Adams describing that response, he was not actually upfront about it. But that changed in 1774 and early 1775 because those older men began to get busy elsewhere or they disappeared off the scene. Dr. Thomas Young moved to Newport and then Philadelphia. William Molyneux died in October 1774. By March and April of 1775, Josiah Quincy was out of the country. Samuel Adams and John Hancock were getting busy with the Continental Congress and staying out of Boston because they were afraid of arrest. The town clerk, William Cooper, left Boston shortly before, in the middle of April, shortly before the British March. So really, when it came down to April 18th, 1775, Dr. Joseph Warren had become the senior leader among the Boston Patriots, the only man on the ground inside Boston, and the man whom other organizers and activists were looking to for leadership.
Could you talk about his traditional story of how he gathered intelligence?
Well, the usual story, by which comes out of many recent books, is that Warren was gathering information from lots of different sources. One source that gets a lot of credit is Paul Revere, because he left a detailed discussion of his ride, and in it he mentioned that he was part of a committee to collect information, although he doesn't really speak to information on April 17th and 18th. There are other traditions which appear across the 1800s of families saying, well, I heard this, my uncle, my great uncle was a stable boy and at the governor's mansion, and he's noticed something or heard from an officer and brought this information. And so the consensus has been that Warren sort of developed a lot of information from different sources. Then in that book, Paul Revere's Ride, David Hackett Fisher posited a theory which had been floating around but almost always refuted before, which was that Warren got some sort of inside information from General Thomas Gage's wife, Margaret Kemble Gage. And that, of course, got a lot of attention at the time, even though Fisher was just saying it was a possibility. He said that there was this moment in which Warren went to a last source to find out a crucial source. Now, all that tradition, all those authors were sort of overlooking the earliest source on where Warren got his information, which was something written down by a man named Jeremy Belknap all the way back in late 1775, so within a year of when this actually happened. But historians were ignoring that source.
John, you write about Belknap's diary in your article, and you say that historians are often skeptical about it. Could you maybe explain why?
Jeremy Belknap, he was a minister from New Hampshire. And he came down to the siege lines around Boston in September or October of 1775 to visit with the New Hampshire troops, to see what was going on. And he kept a diary of that trip. And then he went back up to his home in New Hampshire. And he the last entry of this diary, which was published in 1860 by the Massachusetts Historical Society, said that he spoke with a man named Mr. Waters. And Mr. Waters told him about Dr. Joseph Warren hearing from a crucial informant who the Patriots had kept in pay for that purpose, i.e. a paid informant, somebody who was not doing it for patriotism only, but doing it also for money. And this is the source that, although it's so early, it's October 1775, historians have been leery of it. Now, at first, maybe American authors didn't like the idea of a hero like Dr. Warren paying for information, that, another more logical objection, which I think shows up especially in the 20th century and afterwards, is that, you know, how did Belknap, a minister in New Hampshire, get this information when he's up in New Hampshire from this man named Mr. Waters? Who is Mr. Waters? Why would we expect Mr. Waters to have any information? There's nothing in the diary that says, you know, Mr. Waters, who was an officer of the Continental Army or anything like that. It's just Mr. Waters says this, and then there's this bombshell about a paid informant. So a lot of authors have sort of set this aside as just camp gossip, as just a rumor. Mr. Waters was, you know, a local farmer who was just talking out of his hat. Story was rarely used at all. David Hackett Fisher in Paul Revere's Ride, he took the phrase about going to one more informant to find out that Dr. Warren was checking with one more person. He used that, but he left out the rest of the story, and he said that the one crucial informant was the general's wife.
John, this brings us to Josiah Waters. Who was that?
Well, when I went looking for Mr. Waters, the first people I looked at were Josiah Waters. And I say were Josiah Waters because there was a father and son, both the same names. Josiah Waters Sr. was a merchant. Josiah Waters Jr. was a merchant as well. He was the junior partner of Josiah Waters and Son's firm. Josiah Waters Sr. was a captain in the Boston Militia. Josiah Waters Jr. was a lieutenant in the Boston Militia. They are almost inseparable in this period, so it's really hard to tell which one is doing things at different times. But what I can see from Josiah Waters is that that both father and son, once war broke out, they were entrusted with laying out and helping to build the fort in Roxbury, which was where, at the bottom of the Boston Neck, the narrow isthmus of land that connected Boston to the rest of Massachusetts. So if the British Army decided to charge out of the town where they were besieged, they would come down the neck into Roxbury, and the Waterses helped build this big fort to make sure they didn't do that. And it worked. They never came down. The Waterses got praise from Samuel Adams, from John Adams, from General William Heath. They were really very tight in the Boston Patriot crowd. So that's one thing that was important about them. Another is that the father had invested in land in Maine. And in fact, the land which they invested in, and which I think Josiah Waters Jr. went to visit in the fall of 1775, was right across the Maine New Hampshire border from the town where the Reverend Jeremy Belknap was the minister. So when Jeremy Belknap wrote in his diary, Mr. Waters says, it's a good chance that this was Josiah Waters from Boston. Now, Jeremy Belknap, he is known now for having written a history of New Hampshire, and he helped to found the Massachusetts Historical Society, and he collected a lot of historical information. For instance, that account by Paul Revere of his ride was a letter written to Jeremy Belknap. So he was actually one of the best historians around in early America, and he would not, I argue, have written this account in his diary of what Mr. Waters told him if he did not have a good reason to believe that Mr. Waters was a reliable source, not just some local farmer, but somebody who had actually been part of the Boston Patriot movement, who and that all those clues come together to point to Josiah Waters, probably junior, maybe senior, somebody coming up from Boston to look at the family lands in Maine and then talking with this minister.
How did these two men's experiences help you hone in on the identity of Warren's informant?
Well, one thing that helps a lot is having been researching this very relatively narrow area of pre-revolutionary Boston for 25 years now, is I've got a pretty good database of notes and knowledge. And so when I see something like Mr. Waters, I can think, okay, let me look up more about Josiah Waters. And I discovered that in notes that, in fact, he was known for talking about military lore. He was known in the early Republic for being the sort of old veteran who would talk your ear off about the way the Revolutionary War was fought, and he even wrote a book about this, but it got never got published. So it made sense in character for him to be the sort of person who would not only be involved in the preparation for war by the Boston Patriots, but to talk about it later. And in fact, I found a second source of Josiah Waters's recollections. Unfortunately, the manuscript he's working on has disappeared. But other people remembered hearing from the old colonel, he was by then a militia colonel, about what had happened just before the war. And they remembered another story that he told, and which was passed down from father to daughter to the New England Historic and Genealogical Record magazine. And that talked about a particular source, which Waters said he himself had cultivated and then brought to Dr. Warren, a man named Jasper. And so I was able to put that together with the story from Belknap about the man in pay and think, okay, these seem to be the same person. A man being paid, both said that this was a British man by birth, and that he had crucial information for Dr. Warren. So that allowed me to start looking for a man named Jasper.
John, what do we know about this figure, William Jasper?
There is a thin paper trail. A man named William Jasper arrived in New York in the mid-1760s, saying that he was from London. He was a cutler or knife maker, and he advertised especially that he made surgical instruments. So he made very, very sharp knives. In the late 1760s, he moved to Boston. He got married. He seems to have had children at that time. Unfortunately, unlike many people in Boston, his marriage and the baptism of his children do not show up in church records. So I think that he may have been going to one of the churches that we don't have the records for, possibly one of the Baptist churches. He advertised in New York, which is how we know that he was there in the mid-1760s, but he didn't advertise in Boston. I think Waters said that he had his shop at a little place in the center of town, Waters referred to him as a gunsmith rather than as a knife maker or a cutler. But I think that either way, the point was that he was making weapons, and in fact, he had some sort of contract or arrangement with the British Army. So as a man from Britain, as a man who did business with the British Army, as a man who was renting space to a sergeant major, according to Waters, Jasper seemed to be a person that the British military could trust. And yet, according to this story, he was also taking money from the Patriots to provide some information of what he had heard from this sergeant major.
John, this may be a tough question. What firm conclusions can you draw from this exercise?
Well, I think that it is It does look like the evidence is strong that the Boston Patriots were not above paying for information, paying an informant to betray the trust of a British sergeant in order to provide crucial information about when the British would march and where. The other, another less firm conclusion, or I'm not firm about this. Was Jasper, in fact, the crucial, decisive informant that caused Dr. Warren to say, okay, the British march is definitely on? And I'm not quite so sure about that, because since our information comes from Waters, Waters may have seen himself as being the crucial, being at the center of events, as being a crucial link in this chain. And, you know, we all tend to have that bias, that we see what we're doing as important, as very crucial. And it may have been that what Jasper's information was just another piece of the information that Dr. Warren used. But if we believe that what Waters told Belknap in October 1775 is correct, and at that time Waters was not playing up his own role, then this was the moment that Warren needed to hear from Jasper before sending out his messengers, William Dawes and then Paul Revere, to Warren, Hancock, and Adams in Lexington. So I think that this provides another insight into how carefully Dr. Joseph Warren and his associates gathered information and how much preparation they had put into it before pulling the trigger to send the warning out into the countryside at the right time.
John, how does this article help us understand the Revolutionary era better?
Well, I see two main takeaways from this. One is that it's useful to look at old sources like this Jeremy Belknap diary. It's been published, it's been in print since 1860, since before the Civil War, and yet it had been discounted by historians because they were missing this crucial piece that, okay, who is Mr. Waters? Why does Belknap think that Mr. Waters' information is valuable? And once thought of connecting Mr. Waters with Josiah Waters Jr. in back from Boston, then everything clicked into place, and it this all made sense. And that wasn't, we always talk about, oh, wouldn't it be nice to find a new source? And yes, it would be. It would be terrific to find new sources. That's fun too. But sometimes looking at an old source through a new lens or with a little bit more information can make everything come together into focus. Another takeaway that I think is very important in this is that Dr. Warren had prepared, and Josiah Waters and others had prepared William Jasper as an informant probably months before. This was not a spontaneous thing where they went out on April 17th or April 18th and said, "Hey, you know what's up? What's up with the soldiers?" No, this was something which. This was an arrangement which must have been months in the making. And this, again, speaks to how crucial the preparation, the run-up from 1774 on was, that back in September 1774, it became clear to both sides military preparation, and so both sides began grabbing our artillery, which is the subject of my first book, The Road to Concord. They began gathering more men and organizing the militia, and on Gage's side, bringing in more troops from other parts of North America. At some point in that time, Dr. Warren and his colleagues began setting up this more formal and paid information system. And we also know that on the royal government side, General Thomas Gage was paying information, including one of Dr. Warren's top colleagues, so that it's not that suddenly everything goes kablooey in the middle of April 1775. In fact, that conflict at that moment had been basically in preparation since the latter months of 1774. And what set it off was orders from London, orders from a government that didn't quite understand the situation as well as Thomas Gage did. The story of William Jasper is just another tiny link in that story of both sides preparing for war for months before war actually broke out.
J.L. Bell, thanks again.
Thank you, Brady.
The music played in this episode included works by Kevin MacLeod and the Sturbridge Colonial Militia. Any unauthorized reproduction or use of this podcast without the express written permission of the Journal of the American Revolution is strictly prohibited. For everyone here at Dispatches, I'm Brady Kreitzer saying so long.